Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. They're creepy and they're spooky, and I'm not talking about the Addams Family. No siree, we're talking about the DVD gurus who are back in the house to talk about creepy, spooky films for this Halloween season. We'll talk about Mad Love and Fright Night and Halloween 2 and The Exorcist 3. And nobody can put the fright of Halloween night deep into your mind better than our gurus. They are Mitch Bryan, who is a screenwriter, UMKC film prof, and a writer for 435 South. Mitch, good to have you.
It's great to be back here.
And film critic Jason Heck. How are you, dog?
I'm taller than Mitch.
Yes, you are.
I've got that going for me.
Yes, you do. You have a lot going for you. Don't ever forget that either.
That's Axe body spray you're smelling.
Tough to put together a list here, or not really, or lots of crazy things.
It's our favorite show, isn't it? Isn't it kind of Halloween is always, we kind of...
And this time we didn't even really theme it. I mean, we've done the horror of Hammer, we've done vampires, but we've been doing this, what, 7 years?
I think this is our 7th Halloween show.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Where did the years go?
I know.
So this time we just kind of picked movies we really liked, just scary movies that we liked. I mean, the only vague theme in mind is that they were all out in the 80s, but that's really about it.
And Hollywood... No, not mine. Yours.
Mine.
Yo.
That's what I said. Why would I talk about yours?
I don't know.
And Hollywood does fright stuff good, right? This is what Hollywood's good at.
There's clearly been a resurgence over the last decade. Horror has gone more mainstream than ever before. And I don't know whether that's because monster kids that were watching these kind of things in the 60s and 70s, and then another generation watching these things as kids in the 80s have all sort of become major forces in the market. But certainly horror movies aren't as outside as they used to be, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess it's like you can turn on the television and you have American Horror Story and you've got The Walking Dead, and that means that there's something – sadly legitimate about them.
Yeah, when you've got something like The Conjuring, which is maybe a $18 million movie that shows up and does a $41 million opening weekend in summer, you know, people are paying attention to horror. And something like The Conjuring seems positively respectable next to, you know, the horrors of something like Saw or Hostel or something like that, which have pushed the boundaries of horror so much that when you pull those boundaries back in and work in kind of a, like, where, like, Insidious and these movies are – they're mainstream entertainment. There's not a stigma attached to horror really anymore. You have some actual real movie stars who are in them. You have craftsmen making them. You always did, but now they're just sort of part of the movie. And it's not limited to October releases anymore. And when you have The Conjuring being dropped in the middle of summer, that's pretty amazing for a scary movie.
It just seems to me the hit or miss quotient with horror seems to be higher than other kinds of films, because you hear about one that's made for 22 cents and makes tens of millions of bucks, and the next one that's a high-budget horror film falls flat in its face.
Well, and that's always the dilemma, because a key component to these movies is surprise. Mm-hmm. And when the studios make these great, big, expensive movies, they don't really want to surprise anybody. You know, they want everybody to know exactly what they're getting. I think a perfect example of that is Carrie comes out today, and the trailers on TV seem to be operating under the assumption that everybody knows the entire story of Carrie, so we're going to show you the entire movie in the trailer. And that's a very interesting strategy. I don't think anybody – maybe they're withholding some things that are going to surprise us, and maybe they've got that's their trick. But I think those bigger studios make these movies, and they don't want anybody to be too uncomfortable or surprised or scared.
Well, that's interesting. Okay. Let's go to a list here. Mitch Bryan, why don't you kick it off with Fright Night 2, The New Blood, as opposed to The Old Blood.
As opposed to The Old Blood.
Yeah.
So this is the fourth Fright Night movie.
Wow.
The first one came out in 1985. It was followed by a sequel in 88. Then the franchise was rebooted in 2011. And now it's actually kind of being rebooted again in this version, which premiered on DVD and pay-per-view, no theatrical release, which is a growing trend in movies today. And not just horror films, but genre movies. And part of that has to do with, I think, the studios making these big, gigantic films that's going to cost them $20 million. $50 million just to market. Mm-hmm. And so these smaller movies are struggling to find a place. So with Fright Night 2, which is a relatively inexpensive picture, and it looks like it cost 10 times what it really cost, Fox Home Entertainment is trying this strategy of just marketing it directly to to the audiences. And of course, Blockbuster and all the brick and mortar video stores have all disappeared, and we saw DVD sales plummet in the wake of all of that. And now they seem to have stabilized, and it seems like this is an emerging market, that there is a niche that's being filled by these smaller pictures that don't necessarily have the theatrical release, and it doesn't seem to matter. I mean, audiences are willing to watch these at home with their friends.
And the quality doesn't necessarily turn out to be all that bad when they go directly. They can be good movies.
I think that's been a major shift, too. You look at, for example, Steven Soderbergh's Liberace movie, which couldn't get a theatrical distribution in the United States. So it wound up premiering on HBO. And it's a movie with two big stars, and it's a high-quality picture. Mm. So I think this is one of those growing pains of, and maybe even an inadvertent blowback of the studios embracing this gigantic business model. And that means what happens to the medium range movies, or what happens to the small movies that have a specific niche market? I mean, Fright Night has a huge fan following. Not only have there been four movies, but there's been comic books. And so there's a definite audience for this. And I think studios are looking through various franchises, trying to figure out what's the sweet spot of that audience. How do we reach them, and how do we create a way to still make money on these movies?
I sort of wonder how you build up a buzz, though, about a film if you don't have the theatrical release behind it to get people talking and sort of engage with it.
You use an established franchise. I mean, that's kind of been – I mean, if you look at Netflix, 20% of what's on Netflix is pretty good. And there's a lot of stuff on Netflix that's awful, particularly in genre movies, especially horror. I mean, this is where movies like Sharknado come from, yeah, right? But the gimmick that this marketing gimmick that they're using is, for example, Mitch and I were talking about this Universal Soldier movie. Universal Soldier came out, I think, in 1991, and it had Jean-Claude Van Damme and Dolph Lundgren. It was a big action picture, and it grossed, I don't know, $100 million. Well, that was 1990. There's a newish Universal Soldier that was made and was kicked straight to pay-per-view or video, and it was probably a $40 million movie. I mean, it's a big, expensive movie. Yeah. It's an awful movie. I mean, it's really, really, really bad. I couldn't finish it. It was that bad. But that's one way
and
to get in.
That's saying something for you.
So yeah, I'll sit. He'll eat anything. Give me a Hot Pocket. So, you say, hey, we're putting out a new Universal Soldier movie, and that in theory there are people who love the first one and are willing to give this one a try, and all they have to do is watch it once and you've made your money, even if they hate it. Mm-hmm. So this is not something that's gonna bear repeat viewing, but like Mitch said, sometimes good stuff sneaks through.
And it's certainly the case with Fright Night 2, which takes the original structure of the first movie and also the reboot, and it reboots the franchise again. So you've got the same characters, new versions of the same characters. But in this case, instead of it being the vampire moving next door, these are kids studying abroad in Romania, which is, of course, is the home of – it's Transylvania. It's the home of the vampire. And their dorm is next door to this building that's inhabited by the vampire, who happens to be, in this case, Jerry Dandridge, but a female version, not Chris Sarandon, not Colin Farrell, but this absolutely beautiful actress, Jamie Murray. And so they – instead of doing Dracula, they do – Countess Dracula, they do Countess Elizabeth Bathory, who was an historical figure who bathed in the blood of virgins in the hope of remaining youthful. The picture is like the predecessors. It's this blend of comedy and horror, and which was the thing in the 80s. The 80s was the great decade of the comedy horror films, and that strategy, which goes all the way back to The Bride of Frankenstein, is the idea that you can soften the audience up with a laugh and then scare the bejesus out of them 2 seconds later. And it has some extraordinary set pieces. The actors are all really good, and it's beautiful to look at. It is. Hmm. It does not seem like a low budget movie, and this is one of those things that just makes my heart, fill with joy, because I remember the days when the movies that you noticed were these little scrappers that came in under the radar and that were as impressive, as clever, yeah, as beautiful as the big boys, and that's, yeah, one of the things that's great about Fright Night 2.
What's the clip we have here?
So this is a conversation between Charlie Brewster, the lead, and Evil Ed, his very excitable horror movie nut best friend, as Charlie begins to reveal the fact that he may in fact have a vampire next door.
What if I told you I had an honest to God real life vampire problem on my hands?
I'd say you're.
Oh, thanks.
Well, it's true. If vampires were real, we'd be no match for them.
They drink our blood and can glamour us in an instant. They run three times fast as us. And, one more thing. They're f***ing immortal.
Oh, God!
Okay! After saying all of that, what would you say?
Who is he?
Not he. She. Maybe the queen she of them all.
Jerry Dandridge, a.k.a. Elizabeth Bathory.
Even now, I'm pretty scared. I'm pretty scared even hearing it. Like, you can't see out there in Radio Land, but I'm actually squeezing Mitch's hand pretty hard right now.
So, a big thumbs up for Fright Night 2 from Mitch Bryan, The New Blood. Okay, the fourth incarnation of that film. Okay.
Mitch Bryan, The New Blood. That sounds pretty good, too. Nice, yeah. I could do that for the next Halloween show.
Jason Heck, how about The Entity?
How about The Entity? The Entity is an extraordinary movie. It is incredibly interesting. Nothing like it has ever been done before or since. It came out in 1981. It got a delayed U.S. release and was kicked out in the U.S. around 1983. Didn't do so well then because a little movie called Poltergeist had kind of stolen America's ghost heart.
Remember it.
It was directed by a Canadian named Sidney J. Fury, who is known for directing awful movies, Superman 4. The Iron Eagle movies, for those of you who like teenagers and fighter planes. But he also did the Ipcress file. So he's got a couple of good ones under his belt. And this movie, it's played – the banality of the movie is amazing. It's Barbara Hershey plays Carla Moran, who is your basic single mom. She's taken a typing class to try and make more money. She's got a 16-year-old son that she clearly had when she was about 18 years old and a couple of younger kids. And one night she is – putting some lotion on her legs in preparation to go to bed, and something invisible punches her in the face, pins her to her bed, and rapes her. It's extraordinary. It is absolutely shocking when it happens, because it's clearly all the elements of a rape are there, the bed moving and all of these other things, but there's no one holding her down. And so it starts happening again, and there is clearly something in the house that is very male and very ugly and very depraved that wants to use her and debase her. There is nothing even remotely good about this thing. There is no hidden message. It's not some tortured spirit. It's just ugly and foul and base. She seeks help from a best friend. You know, she's a single mom. She can't afford to miss work. She's got to make rent, and yet she doesn't want to stay in her house. So, you know, she and the kids sleep in the car because anything but going home again. She is eventually decides she visits a psychiatrist played by the always good Ron Silver, who sort of says, I think there might be some sexual trauma in your history that's leading to this, and let's try and get to the bottom of it. No, it's not repressed anything. It is exactly what we think it is. She then runs into basically some parapsychologists at the bookstore, and they say, you know what? We're going to try and trap it in liquid helium. Yes, science versus the spirit. Anyway, won't reveal exactly what happens there, but the movie, you know, it's shot in this sort of sunny Southern California suburbs, and this house is kind of a charming little house where her kid works on his old car in the garage. And absolutely horrifying things happen in it. The performances are sensational. Barbara Hershey was kind of making her mark. She would be noticed a couple years later. Really,
in Hoosiers, right?
The Right Stuff in 1983.
That's right.
As Glamorous Glennis. Her performance is extraordinary because she has to be terrified and be violated in the truest sense of the word by something that's never seen. So it's a very singular, terrifying performance because she's got to take care of her kids. She's got to keep her house. She's got to keep her job. And of course, who's going to believe her? You know, so we have her trying to wage this battle on multiple fronts. That makes the movie that much more interesting. It was based on a book, which was allegedly.
I've never heard of this film.
Well, it's
never
not.
Heard of it.
It was lost in the shuffle after Poltergeist. It was sort of overwhelmed and subsumed.
But
by
is it a true story or not? Right? Isn't that the
it's
whole gimmick?
It's allegedly a true story.
Oh, come on.
I'm saying it's allegedly a true story. The film was made and released about 4 years after the source novel was first published, and the dust jacket blurb on the book was beyond physical reality, beyond ecstasy and pain. to a dark netherworld of psychosexual truth, which honestly we could crib for the that's been the motto of this show, I know, since its inception. Yes. But it's really an interesting movie. Martin Scorsese calls it one of the 11 scariest movies ever, and it is genuinely horrifying. Obviously, rape is a terrifying violation. But this is absolutely as effective for a man to watch as it is for a woman.
Mitch, have you seen this film?
Mm-hmm, I have.
And?
It's really disturbing.
Yeah.
I won't be going back and watching it multiple times, but it's scary. It's a good, scary movie. Yeah.
Yeah. But just the notion that it's based on scary on a woman being violated that way, that's just – I just struggle with that.
Yeah, I know.
I mean,
I know.
That's just
– I know.
I checked out
I mean,
somewhere.
And that's the thing about the horror film is it's transgressive. You know, it offers these transgressive pleasures and sometimes there are endurance tests and sometimes there's something I just assume not watch. It just depends, you know.
Yeah.
It's a lot scarier than a door slamming or chains rattling.
Oh,
because
I get that.
And it's in her home, right? It's in her sanctuary that she has for her kids, and they have a charming home life. She's a really good single mom, and her kids on two occasions have to watch it essentially happen. Mom is pinned to the couch and they're staring and screaming and nothing, they can't do anything. It's grueling, but it's also really, really
good.
So
if they go to try to remove whatever it is that's causing this problem,
her older son.
They're going to give it all away now.
Okay, can't give it away. Okay.
Bad things happen.
What's the clip we have here from The Entity?
The clip we have is Carla talking to Dr. Snyderman, Ron Silver, for the first time. She is, she's gone to the hospital after her car essentially tried to kill her. It went out of control and she was stomping on the brake and couldn't bring it to a stop. And another doctor has recommended she see the psychiatrist, and he's getting to know his patient.
You were raped by whom?
I don't know. There was no one there.
Okay, so in other words, it wasn't a real man that raped you.
He evaporated.
I see. But you felt him in you, though?
Definitely.
And he felt like a man?
A big man.
Were you in pain?
Yes, of course I was in pain. He was foul.
You mean you smelled him? I see. Did he ejaculate?
I think so. But when my son came in, there was nobody there.
Right. And what did he think? Your son?
Thought I was dreaming.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think happened? Okay, that's okay, Carl.
My goodness.
It'll take more than tranquilizers.
Yeah, okay. Okay, that is The Entity. We're reviewing some of the great spooky films of all time with our DVD gurus. They are Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck. And if you have a recommendation for one of your great spooky films of all time, this is a great time to call. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Again, 816-235-2888. Or drop us an email to uptodate@kcur.org or tweet us @kcurUpToDate. Mitch Bryan, let's move on to a film titled Mad Love.
Let's go all the way back to 1935,
wow,
when the golden age of horror was happening, and it wasn't just Universal. Dracula and Frankenstein had come out in 1931 from Universal Studios, and other studios around town said, this is the ticket. These movies were big, big hits. And so everybody jumped onto the bandwagon, and some of the most interesting horror movies came out of MGM, one of which was Mad Love, which stars Peter Lorre as this bald, bug-eyed surgeon called Dr. Gogol, who is obsessed with the wife of Stephen Orlok, Yvonne, played by Francis Drake. And he, through this obsession, gets so as he pursues and stalks her, comes to realize that her husband, whose hands have been crushed in an accident, needs help. And so he tries this experiment where he grafts new hands onto her husband's wrists. These hands happen to belong to an executed murderer. And before you know it, poor Stephen Orlok is convinced that he has the hands of a killer and that they are causing him to murder people. It's a terrific thriller. It has several twists and turns where you think it's one thing and it becomes something else. But it's all held together by this great performance by Peter Lorre. Now, kids today probably don't have any idea who
Peter Lorre was. Yeah.
But, you know, he was one of the iconic faces and voices of 20th century horror films. and he was famous for playing the child killer in Fritz Lang's M. He came to America, and he was in crime pictures like The Maltese Falcon. But this is one of those sort of tour de force Peter Lorre horror performances. And poor old Colin Clive, who plays Stephen Orlok, who had played Dr. Frankenstein in both Frankenstein and The Bride of Frankenstein, is completely beside himself through the entire film. He was always very good at playing these really nervous, high-strung characters. He was a notorious drinker, alcoholic. In fact, he would die 2 years after this picture came out, essentially of chronic alcoholism. But his performances were always riveting because there was just something about this guy who was so uncomfortable in his own skin, and he brings that to bear in this picture.
Okay. What's the clip we have here?
So he has come to see Dr. Golgo and complain about his new hands.
Dr. Who?
Dr. Golgo.
Golgo.
Golgo, who's Peter Lorre.
Yeah. Okay.
Monsieur Orlok. What have you done to me?
Come in here.
You and your black magic.
What's wrong?
You know very well.
Now, what is it?
I've just come back from Gérard. I've seen Dr. Marbeau. He told me that my hands were crushed beyond saving and that these aren't mine.
Marbeau. Who is this Marbeau?
Well, whose hands are these?
What's wrong with them? 10 fingers, every nerve, every muscle works perfectly.
What's wrong with them? They have a life of their own. They feel for knives. They want to throw them. And they know how to. Watch! And that's not the worst. They want to kill. And today they try to kill my father.
And this Mad Love holds up pretty well, even from the 1930s?
It's great. It's so weird and obsessive and sort of twisted.
Wow.
In fact, it was one of the films that took such heat when it came out because it was dealing with you know, such disturbing material that MGM basically said, because the British didn't want to run this movie, a couple of other countries didn't want to run the movie, MGM finally said, to heck with it, we're just going to go make musicals. And they got out of the horror film business entirely until, like, I think 1941, when they came back with a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde movie.
Wow. Okay. Well, lots of folks calling with their recommendations for great scary films for this Halloween season. Let's go to some calls now. And Leonie from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Hi, good morning. It's Leon.
Oh, Leon, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Yeah.
So my favorite movie is kind of related to The Entity. It's Possession from, like, 1981. It has Sam Neill and Isabella Adjani, and it is so good and so weird, and I love it so much, and I just wanted to let you know.
Yeah, and the monster, isn't it? H.R. Giger made the monster, the guy who designed the monster,
yes,
from Alien.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a weird, crazy, strange, wonderful horror film. Absolutely.
I love that movie. Yes. Yeah. So,
and it's titled,
that is all.
It's titled Possession?
Yes, Possession.
From 1981.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good recommendation, Leo. I appreciate it. Okay.
No problem.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Pam from Overland Park. Pam, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Yeah, Rosemary's Baby in the late 1960s.
Oh, yeah. What do you like about it?
That was that whole creepy psychological, the best.
What grabs you about it, Pam?
Oh, well, I had my leg in a cast, and I saw that movie, and I couldn't sleep because I kept thinking, I wonder what's underneath my cast. In other words, I wonder what's inside of me. Oh, my God, what's going to happen?
My goodness. I'm glad you called, Pam.
And there's on those primal fears.
There's a new edition of Rosemary's Baby that just came out on Criterion, and it looks absolutely beautiful, more beautiful than ever before. It's a gorgeous film to begin with, but this is a great new transfer, so you should check out the new Criterion version of
Okay, thank you. Thank you, guys. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Pam. Our number here again, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Jeff from Kansas City, Kansas. Good morning. You there, Jeff?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I had a recommendation, the movie Triangle, which is pretty recent. I don't know if anybody's seen that. It's really good.
Mm-hmm. You stumped our gurus here, Jeff.
Okay, yeah, you definitely want to see Triangle. It starts out looking like it's just a slasher film on an abandoned luxury liner, but then something happens that makes you think, oh, this is not that kind of movie. Something great's happening.
Is it Triangle like Bermuda Triangle?
Well, that's the suggestion,
yeah.
But it's it doesn't really have anything to do with the Bermuda Triangle.
Cool.
And this is from the 1980s, you're saying, Jeff?
No, this is fairly recent, within the last 10 years.
Hmm. Yeah.
We'll give it a look, man.
Yeah, okay. Thanks.
I also had a question. Do you think there's anything to the theory that horror booms come and go with different political climates? Like, you know, during the Reagan years,
interesting.
We probably had the biggest horror boom of all.
Well, in the go-go 80s, you certainly had a resurgence of big horror, like American Werewolf in London, right? So that's when you had Hollywood with a lot of money making bigger pictures.
A lot of the 80s horror films, though, have this comedy thing going on with them, which I think has to do with – there was still a certain optimism. I would argue that the really scary stuff was happening in the 70s when Vietnam and Watergate were at the height, and we had Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and we had The Exorcist. And then again, this resurgence after 9/11 and the Iraq War, we had this preponderance of torture porn movies where the aesthetic was – just man's cruelty and inhumanity to man, and I think that is a definite resonance in the wake of 9/11 and the Iraq War.
And in the 80s, you're going to have stuff that's a little bit more fun, like The Howling and things like that.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you.
I'm glad you called, Jeff. Thanks. All right. We've got one more phone call here. James from Costa Rica. James, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Hey,
Are you really in Costa Rica?
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
Yeah. I'm previously from Kansas City, though.
Okay.
But I was calling with a film, Tourist Trap, from 1979.
Yeah, we're big fans. We're actually big fans, actually.
I think Tourist Trap and Motel Hell are a great double feature of sort of campy, outrageous horror films.
Yeah, if you like weird baby-faced mannequins and kids going off the beaten path, you can't do much better than those movies. I think Tourist Trap is great.
I think you hit a home run with that one, James. Thanks. All right. Bye-bye. Enjoy Costa Rica. Okay, time for a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good survey of horror films, previewing Halloween here. We'll get to Halloween 2, The Descent, and Exorcist 3. And this music is what, Exorcist 3?
No, it's from Suspiria, actually.
So from where?
Suspiria.
Suspiria.
Yeah. Okay. Which we're not talking about today. We talked about it last time.
At
least a couple years.
Yeah.
We've probably talked about it twice. It's a great movie.
But it's still horror-like. Okay,
absolutely.
Time for a break. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. This hour, we're talking with our DVD gurus, Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck, about great horror films, looking for your recommendations at 816-235-2888, and our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. And Mitch, you gurus have something coming up at the Alamo Draft House that people should know about.
That's right.
And I'm involved.
Along with you.
Yes,
we're all going to be together on Sunday, December 8th, to watch a brand new transfer of All the President's Men.
One of the great films of all time.
So,
just love that film.
And we'll mention that again. I think we're going to do a show on journalism in film in December.
Okay.
But in November.
I call the Pelican Brief.
Okay, you got it. But please, mark your calendars. Come out and see us on December 8th at the Alamo Draft House.
Be talking about this amazing movie, and Mr. Kraske will be talking. The journalist among us will be talking about how formative and important the movie was to him. And we'll take questions
and
have discussion and see an amazing transfer, an amazing movie.
Changed my profession forever, that's for sure. Okay, Mitch, Jason, you're up next with Halloween 2.
You bet I am. Halloween 2 is great. It's terrific. So Halloween comes out in 1978. It's made for $300,000 and makes $70 million. It changes the rules.
Wow.
It's a seismic shift. And Hollywood does the Hollywood thing and makes a bazillion movies that imitate it. So you've got The Burning and Friday the 13th and The Prowler and Don't Answer the Phone, He'll Know You're Alone, and all these movies that are derivative, and they're awful. They're really bad. Halloween 2 is a lot like Die Hard 2. You don't realize how good the second one was until you see everything that came after it and everything it inspired. And so John Carpenter and Deborah Hill, the producing and the directing and producing team behind Halloween, they can write their own ticket. So they make The Fog, which is they sign a two-picture deal and they make The Fog. And Carpenter's then – they want to do this second Halloween movie where Michael Myers tracks his sister down, tracks Laurie Strode to some high-rise apartment where she's living. Well, that eventually changes to a hospital. Carpenter says, I don't want to have anything to do with this. Well, actually, I want to have everything to do with it. I just don't want to direct it. So he scores the picture, he writes it, and he handpicks a director named Rick Rosenthal, who has directed a short film that Carpenter thought was really good. And this is Rosenthal's first feature. And so he takes over. The movie picks up minutes after the first one ends. Michael Myers has killed three teenagers, and
it's always teenagers.
God bless him. And his doctor, Sam Loomis, played by the terrific Donald Pleasance, the obsessed doctor, shows up, puts six slugs into him, and Myers gets up and walks away. Mm. So we pick up right there. We have the town is there's a police dragnet trying to get everybody, and Michael is still in pursuit of Laurie, who is taken to Haddonfield Memorial Hospital, which is this perfect horror movie hospital. It's staffed by exactly 10 people. There appear to be no patients, and the corridors keep having lighting troubles. So what he did was Rosenthal tries to imitate a lot of Carpenter's stylistic touches. We start off immediately with a subjective point of view, Michael's point of view, which was very crucial throughout the movie, the original. We're doing some kind of Michael at the periphery things, but unlike Carpenter, who hid Michael Myers throughout his Panavision frame and you just sort of see this mask, Rosenthal makes Michael Myers kind of a focal point of his scenes. So there is no real suspense about where Michael is. The suspense comes from how he's going to off these people. So the movie was – Rosenthal turned in his original cut. Carpenter sees it and he says, quote, it was about as scary as a Quincy episode. So Carpenter himself – a lot of people don't know it, but Carpenter went back and in post-production amped up the gore, amped up the sex, and he basically said, look – I can't have a lot of control over this movie, but what I can do is at least make sure that it's on par with the competition out there. So Halloween become the second one. We have Michael Myers, also known as The Shape, stalking the halls of this hospital and offing the staff in various incredibly creative ways. Very, very new stuff for 1981. You've got a hypodermic needle in the eyeball. You've got scalded to death in a hot tub.
Wow.
While during a sexual tryst, you've got one woman who apparently gets knocked unconscious and has an IV drip placed in her arm and just all of her blood sort of falls out. It's really suspenseful, though. It's really good. It's not Halloween. It's not that good. But it has aged much better than people think. And it has kind of gotten this critical reappraisal. People kind of say, you know what? It did okay. Janet Maslin at the time said the performances were uniformly good. It's got, you know, you've got ambulance drivers and nurses and a drunken doctor. And you've kind of got all these different elements and kind of interesting characters who interact pretty well together. You've got sort of a cast of unknowns, Pamela Susan Shoup, and then some sort of also-rans, Leo Rossi, Lance Guest. And then you've got Donald Pleasance as the obsessed doctor who eventually manages to track Michael down, and there's this big confrontation. But it's actually really scary and really good. Halloween didn't have any gore. That's what people kind of forget. It beget unbelievably gory movies. But Halloween itself is almost completely gore-free. It's suspenseful and terrifying. This, it's more about shock than suspense, but it works really well. And for me, Halloween was the first movie to actually genuinely terrify me. I was in fourth grade. I went over to a kid's house to watch a movie, and he was so scared after Halloween 2 that he went and slept in his mom's bed, and I was left on the floor of his room in a sleeping bag, petrified. I was terrified.
Oh.
And so, yeah, my mom loves telling this story. She, my son, the weenie.
It's like the evil witch and the Wizard of Oz for me. Okay,
it was really scary.
I confess, after seeing Halloween, I really totally remember this, walking out of the Cinema Twin Theater in Hutchinson, Kansas, to my car, getting into my car and turning around and looking in the back seat.
Make sure nobody was back there.
Yeah. It's primal and effective. And this was when Michael Myers was still a boogeyman. This was when he was nothing but evil personified. And now they rebooted it. Rob Zombie made the mistake of trying to explain why Michael is how he is and showing us his childhood. Who cares? He's supposed to be evil incarnate. He can't be killed. He's unstoppable. It's great.
And the clip is?
This is, we have the dragnet is in full effect. We're hunting for Michael. And we have a deputy sheriff talking with Dr. Sam Loomis, played by Donald Pleasance, about how Michael became who he is and what he is.
From Halloween 2.
You know, Haddonfield was a pretty quiet town before tonight. The only gunshots you ever heard were start the track meet at the local high school.
And yet one night in 1963, Michael Myers did murder his sister in that upstairs bedroom with a large butcher knife.
I remember.
On Halloween.
I was 16 years old.
It's his anniversary, Mr. Hunt. He came back.
After 15 years?
He waited with extraordinary patience. There was a force inside him, biding his time. The staff grew accustomed to his immobility and silence. In many ways, he was the ideal patient. He didn't talk, he didn't cry, he didn't even move. He just waited. The staff was unprepared. They didn't know what he was.
Did you know?
Yeah, I knew.
We're talking scary movies. We received this suggestion. Come Out and Play is a great movie for Halloween. Husband and pregnant wife, remote village, and creepy kids. Chris writes, the caller who mentioned Triangle would like Time Crimes. It's a remake of a Spanish movie. Time Crimes is far better, one of my favorites. Blaine suggests the original 72 version of The Last House on the Left. It's a great psychological thriller and truly, truly disturbing. Let's go back to some calls here. And Ellen from Overland Park. Ellen, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I love The Orphanage. Has anybody seen that one?
The Orphanage.
Very good. Very spooky. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really spooky. I think it's a Spanish movie, so you have to be able to read subtitles and not let that bother you, but it has got a really great surprise ending. It's a great one.
I'm glad you mentioned it, Ellen. That's The Orphanage. Yeah. Let's go to Michael from Raymore. Michael, good to have you.
Yeah, good morning, Steve. As a young man, I was quite the fan of horror movies at my local video store, and picked up a title that was kind of in that category, took it home, and just been traumatized ever since. It's a movie called Deliverance. I'm sure you guys are all
Oh, the Burt Reynolds film, right?
Great movie.
Yeah, you know, man. Yeah, all the actors in that movie are just stupendous, including Burt Reynolds. And it's one of those movies, like very like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where it starts ratcheting up the tension from the beginning, and by the end, you're terrified of everything.
You know, I was too young when I saw that film. I saw it with the pastor's kid, like in sixth or seventh grade.
Oh, man.
And Michael, that film hasn't left me either.
Worst play date ever.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Yeah. Let's go to David from Kansas City, Missouri. David, you're on Up to Date. We're talking horror films today. Good morning.
Good morning. 1988, David Cronenberg, Dead Ringers. No ghosts, no vampires, hardly any gore, but one of the most exquisitely disturbing movies I've ever seen. It stayed with me for years.
It's about what, David? What's the hook?
Well, Jeremy Irons, who is superb, by the way, plays identical twin OBGYN surgeons who essentially spiral downward into drug abuse, and the whole world disintegrates. It's just overpoweringly weird, and Genevieve Bujold is also in it, very good as well.
Mitch
tackled it on the show. It's an amazingly good
movie. I love that movie. It's just, I mean, I don't know how you love that movie, but it is so extraordinary. Really great.
David, good call. Thank you. Jason from Kansas City, Missouri. Jason, you're on the air with Jason Heck and Mitch Bryan. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I had a question, and this is more along the lines of being someone in a family, what is the mildest scary movies for Halloween that you can think of right now? I have an 8-year-old son and a wife who just likes rom-coms.
You can't go wrong with The Wolfman with Lon Chaney Jr., a Universal horror picture from the 1940 or 41 is really good. I mean, those Universal pictures are really great. Bride of Frankenstein is fantastic as well, you know, and that's a good way to just kind of get your feet wet with that. And there's also Mad Monster Party, which isn't really scary, but it's like an animated done by the guys who did Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Rankin Bass.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah. It's really good. Kids love it.
Mad Monster Party?
Mad Monster Party. Cool. Yeah, stop motion animation. It's really cool.
Good luck, Jason. Good
Thanks.
Call. Yeah. Let's go to Chris from Lawrence. Chris, good morning.
Good morning. Someone was just asking about mild movies for Halloween.
Yes.
And I've seen some of the most frightening. I mean, I think my sister took me to see Third House on the Left.
Last House on the Left?
Or Last House from the Left, when I was like 7 months pregnant. Okay, so I've seen the worst of the worst. However, if somebody's looking for milder fare, Vincent Price.
Yeah.
Boris Karloff. I watched The House on Haunted Hill the other day. It's like incredibly corny for a lot of us.
Yeah, it's William Castle. It's a pretty hokey movie, but pretty fun. I did House on Haunted Hill on the show, and I love it.
Yeah. So anyway, so that might be a fun thing to do, and put that scary music CD, you know, in the player or not. Not CD, but cassette tape. I'm sorry.
All right.
Anyway.
Chris, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Yeah.
Thank you very much. You guys have a great Halloween.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Good night.
Let's go to Greg from Sparta, Missouri. Greg, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Well, thanks.
Go ahead, Greg. I can't tell you why, but a movie that's always stuck with me and scared the bejesus out of me and my brother was the original Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
No, we're getting some nodding heads here, yeah.
Yeah, it's a scary, especially if you saw it in an impressionable age. That's a movie that to a kid feels very plausible and very scary.
Yeah, my brother, he's dead now, but before he passed away, we always used to aggravate, even as adults, we aggravated each other about the little raisin monkeys come out of the fireplace.
Raisin monkeys, about the best term I've ever
That's
heard
awesome,
for the
yeah.
monsters in that movie. Yeah, yeah, it was scary. I watched it when I was probably 11 or 12, and I was freaked out.
Raisin
All
monkeys.
Right, Greg, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Happy Halloween to you. Okay, we have one film left for each of our gurus here today. Mitch Bryan, take us into The Descent.
The Descent from 2005 is a really scary movie. I think probably of all of these films, I think that would be the one I would say is the scariest.
And it's the flat out most terrifying.
Because it's a very unique film. It's about a group of five young women who go on a trip together, and they're spelunking, they're cave exploring. So one of them has been traumatized by the death of her husband and child. She's reunited with her best friend Juno, who is this sort of alpha female who's planned this adventure. And together they go into this cave, thinking they're going into one cave, but realizing as we get into deeper into the story that in fact they've been misled and they've gone into an unexplored underground labyrinth that happens to be populated by blind albino flesh-eating creatures.
Oh my God.
And it is so suspenseful. If it's not scary enough that you're claustrophobic and you're going through chasms where you have to rappel down walls and it's total darkness, then there's these things that want to eat you that are on the loose in the cave. And it is a hell of a ride. It really is a terrific film directed by Neil Marshall. And that would, you know, that's one that you should definitely see if you haven't.
Yeah, I'd get as claustrophobic when you know, with the I get as uncomfortable with the claustrophobic stuff when these women are shimmying through, you know, these 2-foot tunnels that are, you know, 10 feet long. And it's like, you know, like a sausage in a tube. And that's terrifying enough. Never mind the horrifying creatures that are stalking them. And it's so well made and so good.
Man. Really good. Okay. Made. And we have a clip here from this
film. Yeah. So here's one of the key moments where Sarah realizes that her friend Juno has misled them about where they are actually exploring.
For Christ's sake, Juno. I knew this wasn't right.
You filed a flight plan to Mountain Rescue. If we don't report in, they'll come looking for us.
Yeah, that's how it's supposed to work, except I put in a flight plan for Borum Caverns, and this isn't Borum Caverns, is it, Juno?
We're in the wrong cave.
Holly was right. Borum Caverns was a tourist trap.
Don't try and pin this on me.
This is not caving. This is an ego trip.
Come on, Rebecca. I didn't know this was going to happen. This is exactly what we believe in. We've always said if there's no risk, what's the point?
Well, don't try and justify this.
Where are we? It hasn't got a name. It's a new system. I wanted us all to discover it.
Mm. And boy, did they discover something or other.
They got something going on there. Okay. I hold the last film in my hands. Not Exorcist 1, not Exorcist 2. Jason Heck wants to talk about Exorcist number
Three. Yeah, William Peter Blatty, who wrote The Exorcist. Obviously, it became a money-making machine. It was the book was a colossal bestseller. The movie was a colossal success. So he had was being pressured to follow it up, and he came up with a story called Legion, which is from a Bible reference where Jesus comes across a man who is possessed and asks him his name, and the man says, "I'm called Legion because I have many demons inside me." And he comes up with this sort of story, and it gets stuck in development hell, and he finally signs a deal with Morgan Creek Productions that says he wants to direct, and they say, great, direct it. So William Peter Blatty, who is a sensational writer, if you read The Exorcist, it is an eloquent, beautiful, superb book. It's not just scary. It's really well done. He makes two-thirds of an incredibly great movie. He makes this movie that is quirky and funny and interesting and scary. And so we have George C. Scott as Lieutenant Kinderman, who is a friend of Damien Karras, the priest who dies at the end of Exorcist in the fall down the stairs. He is investigating a series of murders, and the murders lead him. The murders all are sort of blasphemous. A priest is murdered, a boy is murdered and crucified, and he is led to sort of a mental, neurological wing of a local hospital where all of these sort of senile older folks who are have senile dementia are kind of sitting there, and he's like, okay, these people have their fingerprints at the murder, but they're sort of in a vegetative kind of state. They don't know what's going on. So we have all of this stuff going on, and then we have what may be a serial killer who was long killed, named the Gemini Killer, and yet these victims are all being found with his mark on them, these very distinctive mutilations. So how is this happening? Is it a copycat? Well, it can't be a copycat.
Don't look at me. I don't know.
I'm not asking. It's rhetorical. It's rhetorical.
Yes.
Anyway, unfortunately, they got to the movie, which is essentially a supernatural whodunit, and someone at Morgan Creek said, hey, you know what? We're calling it The Exorcist, and there's not an exorcism. So Blatty, they give him $4 million and he has to shoehorn in this plot with an actual exorcism. And there's this sort of effects laden exorcism at the end that's kind of and it's not really good. But I will say that Exorcist 3 Legion has the greatest doozy of a chair jumping shock scare I've ever seen.
Wow.
I went and saw this with my very best friend, Tony, at Oak Park Mall. And we were
funny how you remember exactly.
Oh,
where
yeah, because we were 15 and feeling pretty cool and awesome and teenager and macho. And I had to spend the night at his house because it was really freaky. And it was genuinely terrifying. The movie is really well made. He's you know, Michael Crichton was this author who wanted to direct and made a kind of some interesting movies. Blatty also directed The Ninth Configuration, which is great. But this, it's like two-thirds of a great movie, and then it was taken away from him, and this other thing was kind of pushed into it, and it's not as effective, but it's
still
a
totally
very
worth
scary
seeing.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's quirky and very interesting and much better than certainly the most recent Exorcist stuff.
And the clip is?
The clip we have is a neurologist named Dr. Temple, who is talking to Lieutenant Kinderman about this mysterious patient who can't possibly be the Gemini Killer, but who just might be.
That man in the isolation tank, you know, the one you looked in on.
Yes.
The police brought him in here 15 years ago. They picked him up wandering the sea in Okinawa, down around Key Bridge. Total amnesia. No ID. They brought him to us here. And his condition grew worse. He ended up catatonic. Completely withdrawn. But recently, well, about 6 weeks ago, he slowly started to come out of it. Every day he got better. Just a little, but better. And then all of a sudden, he got violent. Really bad news. We've been giving him electroshock therapy. And as of 2 weeks ago, he's been in isolation, but the thing is, Lieutenant,
is?
He says he's the Gemini Killer.
I want to thank Mitch Brine and Jason Heck for a great list of films. Their films will be posted on our website, kcur.org. Mitch Brine, thanks. Always good to have you, buddy.
See you next month.
Jason Heck, thank you.